I've been in a process over the last month or so of reading large sections of the Bible in one go and not kind of delving into the detail of it, but just trying to get the big picture, the overall sense of God's heart and God's purposes throughout history. Now, I've been really loving getting both in the Old Testament and the New Testament the wonderful sense of the big picture of God. What is it that the gospel is really? Should I just carry on and assume this will get fixed? Yeah. The big picture of God. What is it that's God's heart, God's intention, God's motivation to us? And does it carry through the Old Testament and the New Testament? And I've been increasingly struck that when we come to think about the gospel, whether you are a Christian and you've known the gospel your whole life, or whether you're someone who's here who doesn't have a relationship with Jesus Christ, but you've heard the Christian message, or you think you've heard the Christian message before, I've been so struck that most of the time we narrow the gospel down to one of its constituent parts and inevitably leave it impoverished. Often in the West, we think about sin or guilt. We've done something that's wrong and we deserve some form of judgment. But the good news is God has forgiven us. In parts of the East, it's more about finding life or finding meaning or finding fulfillment or things like that. And where we talk about social justice as one element of the gospel, or just different facets of it. And over the coming weeks, I'm going to kickstart a series really this week in a broader sense that you're going to carry on for a number of weeks, looking at that big picture, not just the constituent parts, but what is the gospel in its entirety and why is it that it is such good news? What is the joy of the gospel for us to be engaging with? I've been thinking about the big picture of the gospel, and in the framework that I've been thinking about, I've been thinking about life in all its fullness. That the big picture of the heart of God, the intention of God, the motivation of God for us, all of God's interventions throughout human history, it can be summed up by saying God's purpose and God's story in human history is that we would come to have life and life in all its fullness. The Message translation talks about more and better life than you ever dreamt of, life abundantly, life in all its fullness. But I've been thinking, if that's true of God's intention, and what I've been noticing is that when God brings judgment that seems to leave us feeling cold and thinking, wow, what is going on here? God's intention is that we would live. And when God brings blessing, his intention is that we would live. So the whole spectrum of God's interventions in human history, the motivation is that we would come to know life. If that's true, if fullness of life or eternal life in all of its aspects is God's heart and intention and design for us, then I guess the question becomes, why don't we live in that life? What is it that hinders me as someone who is in a relationship with Jesus? Why is it that I don't necessarily experience the fullness of life that is God's heart and motivation and intention for me if all of God's interventions throughout human history are actually geared towards that end, that human beings may come to know life and life in all its fullness? And I've been thinking about really the question of what are the factors from my end that can have a shaping impact as to the extent to which I experience and live in the good of that life. And I'm going to speak a really simple message today. I've got really two main points, and they're basically this. Firstly, eyes that see, and secondly, hearts that respond. And for both of those points, I'm going to look at two facets. Eyes that see ourselves, our need, and eyes that see God. And then equally, hearts that respond to need, and then hearts that respond to God. So both of them are split into this sense of ourselves and our need, and then God. So firstly, do we have eyes that see? It's really interesting to me how throughout the Bible, there are so many times, so many verses that you read that talk about though they had eyes, they did not see, or though they have ears, they do not hear. The sense that you might think that you see, you might have functioning eyes or functioning ears, it would appear to the outside world, but somehow you are blind to the realities around you and deaf to the voices around you. Though they have eyes, they do not see. And I've been thinking about this idea of What is it that we're meant to be seeing? What is it that we're meant to be engaging with? How do we respond to genuine reality? And again, I'm going to just speak to eyes that see ourselves and then eyes that see God. Firstly, ourselves. In the Gospel of John in chapter 9, Jesus is talking about spiritual blindness, and the Pharisees, they're the religious kind of elite, the religious rulers of the day, are really offended at Jesus' discussion. He's talking about spiritual blindness, and they say to him, "What are we blind to?" Completely offended. They can't believe that he would suggest such a thing. And Jesus replies, "If you were blind, you would not be guilty of sin. But now that you claim you see, your guilt remains." It's such an ironic conversation because the reality is they are blind. We know for a fact that many of the Pharisees never really saw themselves as they really were. They were completely blind to their own self-righteousness, to their own hypocrisy, to the fact that they were putting such a heavy burden on other people, the fact that they were very proud, the fact that they never saw what was in front of them in the person of Jesus Christ. And the great tragedy is, if only they could see themselves, if only they could have seen their own need, if only they could have seen their own sin, Jesus was standing in front of them not to condemn them, but to offer them forgiveness and to fulfill the need. So he's talking about spiritual blindness, not to say, "Oh, you know, I told you so, you're blind." He's saying, "You're blind. Come to me and see." But rather they get offended and say, "What? We're blind? How dare you? How dare you say that we can't see?" And it occurs to me that seeing ourselves as we really are is an absolute requisite first step towards being able to address whatever potential needs we might have. I feel like in our culture, particularly in a city like Oxford, there's such a pressure to be together, to be sorted, to be bright, to be together. You know, you've got your life sorted. You're here. You're pursuing academic studies in great universities and colleges, and you have this pressure, this sense of my life is together. I'm together. I don't have significant needs. I'm the cream of the cream. And I just wonder whether we can kind of begin to believe our own hype or begin to believe our own social media platforms that really our lives are all sorted. I remember speaking to an atheist friend, I'm sure I've mentioned him in this context before actually, where I was so struck by something that he said that I thought it was so profound. He was talking about his own journey of how he had ceased to be an atheist. At that point, he hadn't become a Christian, although he is now. He's a philosophy lecturer. And he was telling me that seeing himself as he really was had been for him the beginning of sanity and rationality. Seeing himself as he really was the beginning of sanity and rationality. He was talking about morally seeing himself, basically realizing that he wasn't morally perfect. But actually, there's something very important about seeing our need, not just moral need, but our needs, our weaknesses, our brokenness, because seeing need is the first point towards having that need met. So do we have eyes that see ourselves as we really are? And secondly, do we have eyes that see God as he intervenes in our life? In the Gospel of John, again, in chapter 12, Jesus is looking to the crucifixion, and he says these words, "Now my soul is troubled within me, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. No, it was for this very reason that I came. Rather, Father, glorify your name." And we're told that a voice, the audible voice of God, came from heaven, the voice of God, in front of a group full of people and said, "I have glorified it and I will glorify it again." And what's stunning about this is you have the audible voice of God thundering over Jesus as Jesus says, "Father, glorify your name," and God responds. And we're told in the passage that of the people who were there, some thought that it was thunder. They didn't even pick up language. They just thought it was thunder. And others thought it was an angel speaking. And it occurs to me that we can have all sorts of interventions of God in our life and never notice that it was God. We put it down to coincidences or something spooky happened or, you know, it so happened that when I was little, I prayed for this thing and this thing happened. But once it happens, whilst you're praying, you desperately want God to work and move and act. But when God does, we think, oh, it must have been a coincidence, or we explain it in some other rationalized way. And I'm not saying there's a miracle behind everything that you've ever experienced, but I just wonder whether there are miracles that we've missed, whether there's the possibility that God has been speaking in an audible voice in your life and you've been thinking, oh, that's got to be thunder, or that's an angel. Do we have eyes that see ourselves as we really are? And do we have eyes that are open to seeing God? I'm convinced that God is speaking to us all the time. That's the story of the Bible, is that God loves humanity. He is not a disinterested creator somewhere, some force somewhere far away. He's an intimate father who loves his children. I have a little girl who's two. I cannot imagine my husband being indifferent to her day to day. He's all the time communicating with her, all the time wanting to share something of his heart with her. I'm convinced that the heart of God in wanting us to have life is intervening in our lives all the time. But the question is it possible he's intervening and we're completely oblivious? I wonder if you can ask yourself the question, where in my life is the hand of God right now? Is God speaking to me? Is God challenging me? Is God calling me to explore him more, to explore Christianity? Or is God nudging me in one direction or challenging me in another? And see if you really have eyes that see. See yourself as you are, see God where he's intervening in our lives. So that's the first point, that sense of you need to see in order to even begin to have a response. But the second thing is hearts that respond. So at the point where we have seen, we've either seen our need or we've seen something of God, how are we to respond? Well, what I've been finding is how interesting it is that throughout the Old Testament, there are numbers of times where God mentions that the people of God, Israel, saw their need, saw their weaknesses, saw their brokenness, but they responded to that in ways that were not godly or ways that were not life-giving. Let me give you some examples. In the book of Hosea, which is basically a book that sums up the heart of God for people who are unfaithful, but God remains faithful. It says, when Ephraim, that's a group of people who God had called, saw his sickness and Judah his sores, they turned to God. They saw their sickness, they saw their need, they saw their sores, but it says they turned to Assyria. They turned to some other kind of man-made power. And then the verse goes on to say, but he is not able to cure you, nor able to heal your sores. Then it talks about the people of God lying on their beds, wailing at night. But it says they didn't cry out to God. They were wailing. They were crying. They saw their need. Great, tick, the first part is done. They saw their need. They spent night after night wailing on their beds, but they didn't cry out to God. And then in another verse it says, the judgment of God is coming because you've depended on your own strength. You've seen a need. You've seen a situation that needs a response. And rather than instinctively turning to God to say, God, I need you in this situation, you've looked to your own natural abilities, your own strength, your own abilities. In the book of Jeremiah, it's a very famous passage in the Bible. It says, my people have committed two sins. They have forsaken me, the spring of living water, and have dug their own cisterns, broken cisterns that cannot hold water. And so I guess what I've been thinking about is this idea that you can come to a point where you recognize a need for you in your life. You can recognize that you need a sense of purpose or a sense of fulfillment, or you need love, or you need help, you need healing, or you need strength in an area, or you need wisdom. It's very possible to see your need, and rather than turn to God continuously with that need and have it met and be fulfilled in God, to turn to all sorts of things. In the letter that Paul writes to Timothy in the New Testament, there's this verse that encourages Timothy, take hold of the life that is truly life. Take hold of the life that is truly life. In other words, It's possible in trying to address our needs, in seeing our weaknesses or our brokenness, our own moral failures, to take hold of things that we think will give us life, but they prove to be illusory. And the plea of God to us is, there is genuinely something called fullness of life. That's my intention for you, God says. That's my heart for you, that you would know life. Now, just make sure that as you respond to your need, you take hold of life, which is actually truly life, as opposed to counterfeit lives that will prove to disappoint you. So, the upshot of that is it's a godly thing to see our need. You need to see your need in order to be able to respond appropriately to it. But then the second thing is that you need to bring that need to the right place. You know, in our Western context, we are so, I feel like we all think we'll be the exception. I think that's the best way of putting it. We hear countless stories of people who try to find their and fulfill their needs in relationships or in success, in academic prowess or in careers or in whatever else, in family, in jobs, in futures, and all these different things. And we get told from anyone who's made it in any area of life, whether relationally, career-wise, or anything else, wealth, health, whatever, that it doesn't satisfy. But somehow it doesn't go any more than skin deep with us. We think we'll be the exception. No, I will make it on my own. I will have that family life that will fulfill, or the career, or the success, or anything else. The encouragement of the Bible is, if you want life, if that's your pursuit, if you want life in all its fullness, if that's your passion, that you would experience something bigger, better, life abundantly, more and better life than you ever dreamed of, that can only be found in God. So make sure you take hold of life, which is truly life. And it's interesting as well, particularly again in the Western world, I don't know how many of you have been brought up as Christians, or whether you find yourself here for the first time in a church environment, or you became a Christian later in life. For many of us, we get told, look, when you come to God, make sure you don't just come with a list of things that you're asking God for. Don't come with your massive request list. Come and thank God. Come and worship God. Come and get to know God. Obviously, that's all very important. I don't want to belittle any of that. But it can make us feel that asking God for things, or bringing our needs and bringing our requests to God, is almost like a lesser form of engaging with God, and that's simply not the case. The Bible repeatedly calls us to do exactly that. Where you have need, see your need and bring that need to God. It is actually an appropriate and a wonderful thing to do, and God honors it by responding to that need. The second thing of thinking about hearts that respond is responding to God. As I've been saying, I've been looking at the whole of the kind of the spectrum of God's interventions in human history, all the way from kind of judgment that I just can't always get my head around, through to the incredible blessing of God that God pours out on human beings. And what I found really interesting is that you would expect that if God was pouring out judgment on a group of people, that those people would not turn to God, that they would turn away from God because God seems to be so harsh to them. And equally, you would expect that when God pours out his blessing on a group of people, that those people turn to God because, hey, this is great. God is being amazing to us. So we'll respond by having our hearts open to God. But the truth of human history and the story of the Bible tells us time and time again, that's simply not the case. When God pours out his judgment, there are some who see that judgment for what it is. God's call to say, look, repent. Repent. Why will you die? Turn and live. These are the words in Ezekiel. I take no pleasure in the death of the wicked, God says. Turn and live. And we find that some do. Some respond to the judgment of God by turning, by repenting, by recognizing the judgment is just and saying, oh, I better get my life straight, and turn to God. And they live, and others turn away and die. Equally, perhaps equally surprisingly, there are those who experience the incredible blessing of God. But rather than recognize that it's the hand of God that's blessed them and turn even more to God and say, yes, God, I want to live with you, they turn away and they assume it's something special about themselves, or they grow increasingly arrogant and proud. And we find that repeatedly the Bible tells us of the downfall of people who in a time of blessing did not turn to God. So I'm thinking, wow, God could be intervening in our lives in a whole spectrum of ways. And it really is our response that can change whether we live or die, both figuratively and literally, live or die. My husband Toby and I, we've been married for 7 years. In the first years of our marriage, let's just say that we had more than one slightly more tense marital conversation where basically it came down to this. Toby has an uncanny ability to be watching any movie at all, literally any movie. It is the most annoying thing. And basically give you the plot that's going to happen, regardless of how many twists and turns there are within the first 5 minutes of the movie. So I'm watching a movie. I have no desire to know how this movie clearly is going to pan out because I'm watching it for myself. And Toby will be sitting next to me going, oh, I bet I know what's going to happen. And then he'll tell me exactly what's going to happen, even though he hasn't seen the movie either. So really annoying. And let's just say we've had some conversations about this. He doesn't do this anymore. If you ever watch a movie with me, I require total silence is where I'm at. I don't like that in movies, but I do like that with the Bible. I do love, so when I watch a movie, it never even occurs to me to think, oh, I wonder what will happen. I just like being told what's going to happen by the movie, if you know what I mean. When I come to read the Bible, I love thinking, how would I expect this story to end? Or how would I expect this sentence to end? See, if you're familiar with the Bible, or if you're familiar with Bible stories, whether or not you're a Christian, you can become so familiar with these stories that you forget to be surprised. We already know the ending, so it doesn't surprise us anymore. Whereas actually, so many of the stories in the Bible are so unbelievably surprising in their ending. Let me just tell you some of them. I'm thinking here about the response to God. Firstly, the response to blessing. In the Gospel of Matthew in chapter 8, we hear that Jesus heals two demon-possessed men. These are men who have been chained up, and no one goes through that territory anymore because they are so frightened of these men. And Jesus comes and heals them, and the news immediately explodes in the region. And we hear that the whole town went out to meet Jesus. So they hear this news, this unbelievable miracle has happened. The whole town comes to meet Jesus. And you're expecting them to say, well, I don't know, what are you expecting them to say? I would expect them to say, oh my goodness, you have healed these two people who couldn't be healed. Please come and heal everyone else. I have this friend, this person in need, that person who's sick. Come and heal them. And instead we hear, when they saw Jesus, you're expecting, please deliver everyone else. They pleaded with him to leave their region. What a surprising ending to the story. Two chapters later, the exact same scenario, the same supernatural Jesus goes into a territory. All of the surrounding towns hear that he's there and that he can heal people. And we're told it's almost exactly the same sentence structure. They sent word to all the surrounding country. People brought all who were ill to him and begged him. Whereas the previous sentence says to leave their region. In this context, it says begged him to let those who were ill just touch the edge of his cloak, and all who touched it were healed. How you respond to a supernatural God may be the difference of whether you ask him to leave or whether you ask him to stay and bring a supernatural power into your life. There's a response to challenge. We're told that Jesus told the Pharisees that he didn't want sacrifice, he wanted mercy. He said to the Pharisees, go and learn what this means. I want mercy, not sacrifice. A few verses later, a few chapters later, they're having almost exactly the same conversation again. It's in the context of the Pharisees being angry that Jesus might heal somebody on the Sabbath. And Jesus again says, I want mercy, not sacrifice. And he heals the person. You are expecting the story to end with some kind of celebration. A man with a crippled hand has just been healed. But instead, we hear this unbelievable, very bizarre ending to the sentence, which is the Pharisees went out and plotted how they might kill Jesus. Isn't that crazy? If we had someone in this room who just healed someone supernaturally, who would have thought that the response of someone would be that they'd go out and want to plot to kill that person? What's interesting, though, is that we know that at least some of the Pharisees responded to God. When he said, go and learn what this means, I want mercy, not sacrifice, we know at least some of them responded to that challenge by doing exactly that because they became his followers. But others turned their backs on God and decided that they would want to kill him. Let me end with these few more minutes. There's the response to God when you don't understand what God is doing in your life or where God seems harsh and you don't know whether you can trust him. We're told that a Canaanite woman came to Jesus and said, my daughter has been suffering terribly from an evil spirit. Please, can you heal her? And Jesus effectively calls her a dog and tells her to go away. It's unbelievable. There are ways of interpreting that passage in cultural understandings, but you can imagine she would have been deeply offended. And the natural response, maybe how you're expecting the passage to end, is that she turned away from God and walked away, but she doesn't. She surprised me. She decides she will continue to trust. Is it possible that in your life you've become offended with God because you haven't understood something? And actually, if you would just turn and trust, she presses in one more time and says, no, really, heal my daughter. And her daughter is healed. It's the difference between death and life. And finally, the response to an appeal. One of the most moving passages in the New Testament for me is in the Gospel of John, at the end of a festival that's symbolizing God rescuing his people. Jesus, God himself, stands in the middle of the temple. The temple symbolizes Jesus. And he, we're told, raised his voice in a loud cry and said, if anyone is thirsty, come to me and drink. And we know that hundreds of people just passed by. They never even heard it. They never responded. It would have been life to them. Hundreds passed by, but some heard the appeal and responded. I want to leave you with these questions. Are you thirsty? Are you looking for life? Is life in all its fullness part of your life trajectory, part of your life kind of bucket list? Life in all its fullness. I want to really encourage you. There are two requisites for that: eyes that see and a heart that responds. God's intention for you is that you would know that life. That's God's heart for you. So it's on the table. The offer is there. The question is, will you kind of faff around with life that isn't life? Or will you give yourself wholly to God? I was so struck in the worship singing that song about God being a consuming fire. You know, in the Old Testament, it talks about a situation where the priests came and gave a sacrifice, and the consuming fire of God came and burnt up the sacrifice. The very next verses talk about priests who came and gave a sacrifice in a way that was dishonoring, that was half-hearted, that was actually more about them than about God. And it's exactly the same sentence structure. It says the consuming fire and came and burnt them. God is a consuming sacrifice, but don't, it's consuming fire. Don't play with him. Is it possible you've been a Christian for many years, but you're just relaxed about it? We sang, all of me for all of you. That's what we were singing in the worship. All of me for all of you. I want to, if I can, just appeal to you. I'm not asking you to enter into a religious system. I'm saying the offer is life in all its fullness. The big picture, the joy of the gospel, good news, life in all of its fullness. Make sure that you really are seeing yourself and your need and then responding to God. I'm going to close there. Why don't we just take a moment, just in silence, to just bring ourselves before God and ask ourselves the question, have I seen myself as I really am? Why don't you ask God, is there anything I need to see about myself? And if there are areas of your life that you feel I need to be responding in a different way, maybe this is a good time to do some business with God.